The Move to North Carolina. After another week of kayak adventures, we headed south, stopping by Charlotte to help plot my relocation in the fall. In Las Cruces, I packed up my things, sold my house trailer, and the Pinto, bought a one-ton bare-bones used GM van fresh from the Los Alamos labs, and got ready to roll. Bacchus and a friend with a car came from Denton to help with the driving. After several crises, including a broken axle on my camping trailer, plus a blown tire while fishtailing on a bridge that easily could have turned into a fatal crash, we got the camping trailer to Denton. The Orgone box and flatbed was stranded for a while at a gas station in West Texas while the towing car overheated, but later we went to fetch it. I stored the box at Rainbow Valley under a tarp until I could come back for it next year, and continued on to Charlotte in early November. I arrived into the middle of an unexpected drama. Rainbow was divorcing Arjuna after many fights and several beatings. It was not surprising that Arjuna had a martial attitude towards marriage, since he thought he was the incarnation of the Arjuna of the Mahabharata and Bhagavad Gita. In Hindu literature, Krishna was Arjuna's charioteer on the great battlefield of Kurukshetra. Without the personal guidance of Krishna as his chauffeur, Arjuna was fired after getting into the habit of locking himself in a room at work and falling asleep. In despair, he took 50 hits of my acid in a suicide attempt. He clearly hadn't done his homework, since LSD is not toxic. It took 6 months to get his head back in order, but he recovered, mostly. Meanwhile, I crashed for a month on Rainbow's couch while looking for a place to live in Charlotte. She was soon involved in another relationship, and her new partner visited for a few weeks. The chaos was way over my head. The stress caused a severe bout of iritis, the worst I had ever had, which required injections of cortisone around my eyes. I looked like I had been in a bad bar fight. I needed to find a place I could afford to rent, where I could park my camping trailer and work on my project. I met a fellow I'll call Dick, who had an evangelical mother and an alcoholic father. He had inherited the worst characteristics from both, although I didn't realize this at first. He was a Southern writer, who, with the other local Southern writers, thought that being drunk was a traditional literary necessity. Never mind that the writing done by these characters was an occasional article in Creative Loafing, the city's alternative weekly newspaper. We agreed to rent an old run-down house on several acres of bamboo and tall wild trees, overrun with poison ivy, an island of nature in the middle of the city. At $250 a month, it was a steal, although I had to repair 13 missing windows broken out by a local addict who did not come with the house. I supplied my own wood stove for heat. On our first night in the new house, we held a party, mostly Dick's friends, plus the few that I had met in my initial month. The result was raucous, with quite a bit of booze, and I was duly disgusted. Rainbow and I split for most of it. When I returned at 2 a.m., as I approached the front door, a partygoer lurched out and vomited on the front steps. This was not a positive omen. Then Big Bob, at 350 pounds, the largest of my new friends, announced that he had ignored our warnings and took a dump in the upstairs toilet, which did not flush. Sorry about that. Dick apologized and said things would be better, but after a week his mooching was intolerable. I told him he had to go, and he refused, even though I had paid his half of the deposit. Providentially, the only other house in our wooded lot went vacant, and he moved next door. I was still within mooching distance, so it was all the same to him. Foolishly, I let him use my nitrous tank, and sure enough, he was filling my balloon every day at all hours. After a while, I tired of this, and removed the fitting and hid the balloon, much to his annoyance. Soon the tank was empty, mostly due to him, and I couldn't recharge it, since nitrous oxide was now controlled. Oh well. I put my upright piano in the large living room and continued work on the Munster Variations. This was a large work for concert band, consisting of variations on themes from trash TV of the 1960s. However, I never did figure out the copyright situation and eventually had to throw it all out. Most of my daily efforts went into the Oracle. I bought a small lathe and set up a room as a little machine shop and set to work making parts for the most difficult components. But little could be done until I found another place to live out in the countryside. This was a big challenge, since rural properties usually are for sale, not rent, and my budget was tight. Continuing to tinker with my klepper, I was not satisfied with my outriggers. The sections of inner tube created a lot of drag. I decided to try a radical solution and put ballast on some serious lee boards. I bought a large wok and melted 25 pounds of lead in each of two weights that took the spherical curve of the wok. That way, the lead was streamlined from all directions. I made two oak lee boards 3 feet long to hold the 50 pounds of ballast and fixed a line to their trailing edges so I could pull them up. Then I took the contraption with my kayak and sail rig to Lake Norman just north of town. To avoid sinking if I took on water, I filled the bow and stern with bags of styrofoam. Launching was a nightmare since the lee boards weighed about as much as the empty boat, but once on the water, deep enough to put the lee boards on, the thing sailed like a dream. It was especially good upwind, even with the gaff main that was not all that well cut. It felt like a very big boat, but there was no way to make it safe without sacrificing all the storage room with flotation, so this was the only time I took it out. In June 1988, I drove north for the 15th reunion of my Andover class, where, as always, I was the outlier in every statistical category, especially success. My classmates had gone on to be the doctors, brokers, artists, lawyers, bankers, and such, with wives and kids and houses. Evidently, they were taking things a lot more seriously than I was. One alumna from Abbott was the rich, blonde, and beautiful Marcia McCabe, a soap opera actress who married actor-turned-producer Christopher Gautman. He had played many roles, including a cross-dressing psycho in Texas. Marcia played Sunny on Search for Tomorrow for 8 years, including a graphic rape scene that took an entire episode with minimal commercial interruption. Later, she played Alicia on One Life to Live. After Alicia died, Gabrielle switched Alicia's dead newborn with that of Brenda's, hoping to save Alicia's husband Michael the agony of losing both his wife and his son, and wanting Michael for herself. Later, on Another World, she played Bunny Eberhardt, who was a loan shark and hit woman hired to off Jake. He appeared to die in a car crash, but was really suffering from amnesia and thought his name was Bunny Eberhardt. You can't make this stuff up. I had a friendly chat with Christopher, and I asked him, "Ever think of the millions of hours people have spent watching soap operas instead of doing something productive?" He said, "Goodbye, Bill," turned on his heel, and walked away. I guess I'm not cut out for Hollywood. Besides, my teeth aren't straight. Not long after, in rural North Carolina, I was eating at a local seafood restaurant with a friend. We started a conversation with a fellow at another table, dressed in overalls with no shirt. He said he'd recently left prison. One day, someone on his cell block changed the channel away from his favorite soap opera. He stabbed the guy 17 times. Since no one testified, he got away with the murder. Do you like the flounder? While in Massachusetts, Anton introduced me to another one of his friends, a college lad named Peter. His audiophile father had a used car lot, which I came to regret. On returning to Charlotte, Rainbow's life had settled down just enough for us to do another channeling session, which was very valuable. This was to get guidance for both of us, not just for me and the Oracle Project. We did these sessions in the same way as I did past life readings. First, she would lie down comfortably, and then I'd talk her through a systematic relaxation process. After that, she would expand a bit out of her body in various directions, come back, then expand further, come back in, then expand out many feet in all directions. Then she would float up to just beyond the atmosphere. At this point, I could converse with her spiritual guide. It's a lot more involved than that, but this is the general idea. In this session, it was clear that I needed to be more regular in my spiritual practice, become more pure and devoted and loving, and not take things so lightly. Also, there was karma involved in the acid trade, and my situation was becoming more dangerous. I was advised to buy no more after August. There was specific instructions about the Oracle and what to look for in the rural property. I shouldn't trip any more except for mushrooms, since LSD and other psychedelics would make me too centered in mental activity. In working on the Oracle, and should that work, then on the theoretical side of transcendental physics, I was asking to make a leapfrog in the progress of our knowledge. There was debate on higher planes about whether this was a good idea or not. Since I didn't know the physics behind the device, if they didn't want it to work, a small misdirection would be all that was needed to make the Oracle completely non-functional. The National Rainbow Gathering was in East Texas, way too hot and buggy for me during the first week of July. So I settled on the North Carolina Regional Gathering, where I met many local hippies. One was Wave, the mother of a 6-year-old whose father visited from time to time. In August, she went through a tough spot and needed emergency housing. I had a spare bedroom upstairs and offered it to her for a little while, with the understanding that her child would not come over. My place was an extreme example of kid-unsafe living quarters. Wave moved in, and trouble commenced in short order. I am a very orderly person with regard to my refrigerator. Now, when I opened the door, rotting food fell out on the floor. And sure enough, along came the boy. When I greeted him, he ran over to me and punched me as hard as he could, right in the testicles. When I yelled, he broke into hysterical laughter. Something was wrong with this picture. I figured it was time for my final acid trip, not having dosed in a year. In my elevated reality, I saw the need for corrective action. And so I put all of Wave's belongings out on the lawn, ancient tofu and fetid fruit included. It was hard on her, but sometimes being Mr. Nice Guy is a lot like being punched in the nuts. Sometimes it's exactly like being punched in the nuts. By pooling all my resources for my final purchase, and including what I had on hand already, I had 30 kilo doses on hand. Now came the challenge of what to do with them. My customers were living hand to mouth, and none were in a position to buy 1,000 or more at a time. So I had to front the large majority of the acid to get it out the door by the end of the month. This led to all kinds of complications, and after all the dust settled, I barely broke even. Sometimes I was lied to, other times there were genuine difficulties where someone else needed the money more than I did. It was a relief to be free from the trade. It was a lot of fun while it lasted, but the danger was extreme. When I was active, I had a reasonable social life and quite a few friends. When I wasn't selling acid anymore, my phone was silent. With all the work I was putting into trying to serve in music and fringe science, the only thing that people really wanted from me, or later hated me for, was psychedelics. Everything else was of no interest. This was not what I had in mind. After much searching, I found a property for rent in the little town of Cleveland, an hour's drive north of Charlotte, home to about 600 people and 800 cows. This was across the street from the farm owned by Jim Graham, longtime Secretary of Agriculture, who wore a button reading, "Thank you for smoking." Every once in a while, I'd see his limousine drive by. There was a lot of money to be made peddling deadly addictive drugs. My new place was 19 acres, with 3 or 4 cleared. There was a mobile home that had been made permanent with a roof and enclosed porch, a large garage, chicken coop, workshop, and fruit trees, all for $250 a month. It looked perfect for the Oracle. I moved in late October. As my funds trickled in from my last trades, Anton recommended that I help his friend Peter start up his own used car business using spare space on his father's lot. This way, I could have a completely legal income and be able to continue work on the Oracle, which was entering a particularly expensive stage. Once again, I trusted Anton, and once again, it was an incredibly stupid move. Anton and Peter paid themselves from my money for labor in fixing up the cars, and the rest went to Peter's dad for rent. Over the next year, I lost most of my money. Legal business was not at all as trustworthy as what I had become used to in the acid trade. Kayaking in 1988 included Cape Ann and Cape Cod in Massachusetts, 4 lakes, a river, and Cape Hatteras in North Carolina, and finally a kayaking symposium in Norfolk. There, I was inspired to send off to John Lockwood out in Washington State for his kit to build one of his mahogany single kayaks. In Charlotte, I met Jim McGuire, a photographer and member of the local arts scene, who tracked me down as he had heard of my kayaking exploits. He knew of a great place to explore, so the day after Christmas, we drove down to Cumberland Island. This is the largest and southernmost coastal island in Georgia, right on the Florida border. On the inland side is a major nuclear submarine base, but most of the rest of the land is wild. We paddled and camped for 3 days. Afterwards, Jim was inspired to buy his own used Klepper. 1989 and Life in the Sticks. I met interesting folks through kayaking. One was Waywired Willie, a thoroughly legal pharmacist who knew Jim and also had a Klepper. We went to another kayaking symposium in Savannah in early April. There, I showed off my Paddle Pal, which was my own development of a rig designed by Kybor Tyler, allowing disabled people to kayak. I used a mast and a boom with shock cords coming down that clipped onto rotating bearings in the middle of the paddle. This took all the weight of the paddle and arms, but minimally interfered with paddling. I continued to refine the design for the next 2 years. Another fellow I met was Lou Candle, a doctor in the nearby town of Albemarle, who was also building a Lockwood kayak. It was interesting to hear tales of the medical profession from the other side. Like most, he started out in the field to be of service healing people, but medical school and the materialist norms of the profession forced him to be basically a mechanic for bodies and a lawyer against insurance companies. He wanted to retire, but felt an obligation, especially to his older patients. And yet another paddling friend, David Bolduc, was a podiatrist, but facing similar problems as Lou, got tired of feet and insurance in his face and quit. He and his wife Mindy cruise in their tiny Sharpies designed and built by Matt Layden, taking their 15-foot little cruiser 7 times across the Gulf Stream to the Bahamas. Matt lived on Little Cruiser on Cape Cod for 3 years before selling it to Dave and Mindy, sailing it from the Bay of Fundy to the Exumas. If you ever feel claustrophobic, consider spending 3 New England winters in a box 3 feet wide, 4 feet tall, and 15 feet long. Dave and I sailed my Klepper in the southern part of the Outer Banks in October, which was fine on the water, but there was 70 miles of salt marsh directly upwind, so when we hit the beach, it was a full sprint to get the tent up and hustle inside. Then, after killing mosquitoes that had followed us in, we could have a little peace. The screen door was colored brown from the swarms of mosquitoes. We launched from the Cedar Island home of Mark Balog and Sam Carveth, who ran Balog Sail Designs. They made state-of-the-art sailing rigs for canoes and kayaks, and, naturally, I bought 2 sails and their inflatable outriggers. Jim McGuire did the same. Mark sailed with Russell Brown on his first proa in 1977 in the Caribbean, describing one passage as going up Niagara Falls. One day, I did an experiment in navigating an unnavigable stream. In January, I parked my van 18 miles from home on the South Yadkin River, and a friend drove me back home. The next day, which was right about freezing, I donned my wetsuit and took my whitewater inflatable kayak down to Third Creek, which ran on one end of my property. In I went, not exactly sure that I would emerge at the other end, and in fact, there were many downed trees I had to choose to go either over or under, plus a large dam. A golden retriever spotted me and decided to come along for several miles just for the hell of it. I did eventually get to my van by nightfall. This may not have been the first trip down the river, but it was likely the last, since Hurricane Hugo came over the area in September and tore down thousands of trees. While doing all this, I realized that I was fussing with gear more than communing with nature. There was always some refinement, one more piece of engineering that would make the experience more spiritually rewarding. But here was another variety of the same philosophical problem I had with music, psychedelics, science, and meditation. I was stuck with accumulating a list of experiences, hoping that this would lead me to that place beyond the beyond that I'd tasted so many times. But no matter how long the list got, it was still an accumulation of desired experiences, which would never end. I could point 5 degrees higher to windward after a week's work on new leeboards, or write a fugue in 18 voices, or spend years building the oracle, but this was still just stuff. How do you get to that place where there's nowhere to go? What do you study to get beyond thought? I had problems with periodic depression that lasted 2 years. Stopping steroids may have contributed to the moodiness. In early 1989, I designed and started building a geodesic dome to house my orgone box, which was still in Texas. Art imitates life, and in this case, I neglected the entire idea of a foundation until after the dome was built. I put up a mast and had a cable with a winch, which allowed me to build the dome from the top down. As soon as I finished the very top, I pulled it up the mast and started work on the next lower section. Finally, I had the frame for a 5/8 dome, 18 feet tall and 24 feet in diameter, dangling from the mast on uneven ground. I piled up some cinder blocks on the low side to drop the dome down on, but this was very shaky. Next, I coated the dome with blue poly tarps, then nailed triangles of green canvas over that. With the new windage, the dome blew off the cinder blocks during a storm. I figured out how to lash everything in place and stake down the dome as if it were a tent. Finally, the dome was secure and waterproof, and I could go fetch the Oregon box from Texas. I drove through Nashville, where Mom and Burns had relocated, and Grandma was in a nursing home. She had been in remarkably good health until recently, but now, at age 95, was strapped into bed and badly demented. This was the last time we met. She had been very kind and generous to me, and it was sad to see her suffering. She died in January 1990. She showed up in a meditation shortly afterwards in a dark cloak. I said, "You are beautiful as in the days of your youth," and everything lit up. In Denton, I got Groucho Fleet to help me drive the flatbed trailer back to Charlotte. When I got to the box, the tarp had long ago rotted in the sun and blown off, exposing the box to the elements and ruining everything. I hauled the box back to Cleveland anyway. Groucho was showing signs of a short temper. In time, his life proceeded to unravel. Efforts to save his sorry hide indirectly cost me $4,000 to no lasting positive effect. Before rebuilding the box, I mounted pivots on opposing vertices so that I could suspend the box from the peak of the dome. To make these custom pivots, I found a World War II Navy vet who lived in town who had a machine shop in his garage. He did a great job welding them together. As he was a devout Baptist, he invited me to his church that was very close to my home. I was sampling the religion of the people who made the laws and ran the prisons. In the service I attended, the minister spent his whole sermon castigating Voltaire for his atheism and for exposing the sins of the Catholic Church. The story was that as Voltaire died, he recanted his errors and screamed as he felt the flames of hell licking at his feet. This is what God does to people who write satire and poke fun at the bishops who build grand estates for their mistresses. There was a retired judge in the congregation who at first sight clearly thought I was going the way of Voltaire. I took the mast out of the dome and put in the ruined box on its trailer. After screwing on the pivots and attaching a cable to the two opposing vertices, I winched it up so that the box was suspended from the peak of the dome. I had to get under the dangling box to take care of some details, then left for a minute to check my mailbox. When I walked back to the dome, the top had caved in under the stress, and the box crashed down on the trailer. Had this happened a few seconds earlier, I would have been crushed. Even if I had only been pinned, it would have been fatal in that remote location with so few visitors. I straightened out the crumpled peak and reinforced the whole dome with an icosahedral array of extra struts, so now it could take a great deal of weight. I had to rebuild the box from scratch for the third time with a better design. It took months of work, but finally I had all the 8 panels completed, and with the help of some friends, we screwed the thing together. It weighed 1,200 pounds and can float above the ground and point in any direction directed by one hand. I interact with the locals. Country life requires physical labor, and I was unable to cut my large lawn. One of my neighbors was a very muscular black man named Johnny, and he was happy to have the job. He mowed about half the lawn, then split, saying he'd be back shortly. Shortly was 3 weeks. I looked around for another solution. He had an elderly riding lawnmower and sold it to me for $150. I was barely able to ride it, as any rough terrain was very painful on my joints. But this was not an issue for long, as on the first mowing, one of the axles broke. Johnny took the mower back for repair, and that's the last I saw of either the mower or my money. Johnny's wife was a former crack addict from Philadelphia, trying to straighten out her life here in the countryside. I was aware of the low success rate for such things, and was not surprised when I visited their home one evening and found only their two small children. They said their parents were out partying, and they were hungry and asked me to feed them. I went home and fixed sandwiches and returned. They were very unhappy with me, since they assumed I would take them out to a restaurant. I did not go back again. Johnny was a handy person to know, since one of his friends was talking one day about breaking into my house. Johnny talked him out of it. He saw that I didn't have a girlfriend, and said he knew a black woman who would give me a blowjob for $10, which he described in graphic detail. I declined. From time to time, Johnny would come by and ask for money, but eventually he stopped, since he didn't get any. I learned to be friendly but wary with the local black population. One night, a very well-dressed black woman with a beehive hairdo came to my door. She said she had run out of gas and was looking for a station. I gave her some gas from a can I kept in my van and told her where the nearest station was. The next night, she came back, asking for gas. I opened the door just a crack, told her I couldn't help her, and locked the door. Later, when I told some friends about this, they said this was a standard trick. The woman would keep the person busy at the front door while someone broke into the house in the back. Thankfully, nothing happened this time. My next-door neighbors ran a large dairy farm. I'll call them Steve and Tess. Steve showed me around the barn and the various facilities. He raised veal calves in cages, too small for them to turn around, so they could not exercise, and fed them iron-deficient food for fashionably pale meat. Since the calves were accustomed to sucking on teats, he indicated that they were also adept at satisfying male sexual needs. Now I see why they call it animal husbandry. Tess was a rotund woman with a phobia about snakes. A picture of a snake, or a mentioning snakes in a conversation, was enough to send her into a panic attack, so I was careful not to mention the S word. They had no reticence about the N word, however, and used it without any embarrassment when talking about their black employees. As a card-carrying liberal, I found this bizarre, but kept my mouth shut. Tess did like her booze, something very common in the dairy business, and from time to time would go on a bender. One day she went missing, and eventually led the cops on a long car chase through the countryside. She was in and out of quite a few ditches that afternoon. I learned about it when I heard squealing tires and sirens going past my house. I came outside and found muddy tire tracks in the road weaving from side to side. I followed them over the bridge crossing Third Creek and saw that she had driven into the freshly plowed field across the road and stuck in the deep soil. The sudden stop had turned her sideways, and with her considerable girth, she was jammed between the steering wheel and the back of the seat. The cops and her husband were trying to talk with her, but all they got was a stream of garbled invective. They bundled her up and sent her to a rehab center off in the mountains. Steve divorced her, but would visit every once in a while since, as he put it, pussy is pussy. Better than an anemic calf, I suppose. Despite the example of the local farmers, I took great stock in the value of gardening to get in touch with nature and as a profound spiritual path. I read about the work at Perelandra up in Virginia and Findhorn in Scotland with reservations. The previous occupant of my property had ruined the soil in the space he had cleared for a garden, and most of the topsoil had eroded away. What was left was weakened by chemical fertilizers and pesticides. I did my best to plant a modest garden, but as before, the physical labor was far beyond my capacity. Eventually, the garden yielded a few okra and a healthy stand of 6-foot weeds. From then on, I planted it in clover and let the woodchucks feast. They were fat and sassy and terrorized my poor cat. An old friend from Bruce Hall days at NTSU, Fred Robinson, no relation, joined the Air Force and was the composer, arranger, and sometimes Barry sax player for the band at Warner Robins Air Force Base in Georgia. The band came to Brevard out in the mountains for a music festival, and I went to see them and hung out with Fred for a couple of days. As a result, I started plotting music to write for his musicians, which would preoccupy my musical efforts for the next year and a half. A fateful decision and serious weather. By August 1989, the investment in Peter's car lot had lost $15,000 out of $18,000. With the Oracle expenses mounting and with no acid revenue in a year, my reserves were running low. My options were few. While I was productive with my own projects, I was working at my own pace with plenty of naps and breaks, far more than would be tolerated on any normal job. My kayaking was possible with adaptive gear and help from friends. I knew I couldn't handle any full-time employment, since I was in worse shape than the last time I'd tried. Even if I could find something part-time, I would lose my SSI, rent assistance, food stamps, and most critical of all, Medicaid. With my pre-existing condition, I couldn't get health insurance and wouldn't be able to afford it even if I could get it. My medical expenses were considerable, and lack of health care was not a realistic option. If I tried to live only on my SSI check, I would have to stop the Oracle project, sell my boats, and do very little travel. I might even have to give up living in the country and move into a slum. The option of going back to school would require stopping the Oracle and would take a year to arrange. After much pondering, I decided that the Oracle project was too important to give up and made the fateful decision to go back into the acid trade. Despite the difficulties and dramas, the marvelous experiences I and others had with LSD were profoundly inspirational. The laws were clearly born of ignorance, fear, and greed, and it was important for someone to stand up to this stark injustice, even if there could be dire consequences. My associates were overjoyed, and things picked up where they had left off in short order. In early September, I visited a couple we'll call Bud and Petunia I'd met at Sam's Knob. They lived at Carolina Beach, on the southern end of the North Carolina coast. Bud was a stocky and quite strong fellow, the kind I liked to have in the front seat of my Klepper. Petunia had cerebral palsy and was confined to a wheelchair. That was another kind I liked in the front seat, and we dropped her in for a delightful paddle around the harbor. There had been a hurricane offshore a day or two previously, and serious waves pounded the barrier island. I saw fishing boats slamming against them as they headed out the narrow cut between two islands and plotted my next adventure. Consulting the tide charts, I saw that if we arrived at this cut at 9:30 p.m., we would go out with the last of the ebb tide and could turn around and come back in with the beginning of the flood. Tide currents are maximal when the water is low, since the channel is small. Paddling at night is especially wonderful, and this night there was no moon. The only light would be the eerie green glow from the tritium in my compass. So off we went, me and Bud, who had no experience in a kayak. In my haste, I neglected to bring life jackets, which added a certain edge of danger to the enterprise. When we got to the cut, I noticed that we were heading out to sea very fast, much faster than one would expect at the end of the outgoing tide. Soon I realized that this cut's current was delayed from the overall tide by as much as an hour, and that we were stuck in something like a 4-knot outflowing current. Meanwhile, the hurricane swells were breaking against the shoals all the way to the horizon, much steeper and closer together than normal, because they were against the current and in shallow water. We were swept uncontrollably into 8-foot breaking waves that hit us about every 5 seconds. The froth at the tops of the wave had little buoyancy, so we were totally submerged up to our heads with every breaker. Bud was thrilled at the adventure, since he didn't quite get how serious the situation was. We were continuing to head out to sea, and would continue to do so, unless we could turn around and go along the shore to get out of the rip. But we could not afford to be caught taking the waves on our beam, since that would certainly capsize us, especially since Bud didn't know how to brace with his paddle. Bud could just barely hear me if I shouted at the top of my lungs. I told him we'd have to take a wave on our port bow quarter, then turn as fast as possible to take the next wave on our stern quarter. This was complicated because our rudder was out of the water a good bit of the time, waving uselessly in the air when not flailing in the foam. We took a wave at about 30 degrees away from straight on, then in 3 seconds we managed to turn to take the next wave at about 45 degrees off our stern. Then we straightened out. Now we were hit by waves we didn't see coming that hit me in the back of the head. We had to figure out where we were. There was no moon, and I could only see a couple of lights on radio masts, which told me nothing. The cut was invisible. I figured there was a longshore current due to the waves hitting at an angle, and deliberately aimed to miss the cut by a wide margin. That way I knew which side I would be on and would turn in the correct direction. Eventually, we got in safely. I never forgot life jackets again. Another paddling buddy was Greg Shanding, who worked in one of the big faceless banks in Charlotte. To keep sane, he fished from his canoe. His basso profundo voice is the lowest I've ever heard. He really should sing Russian Orthodox chants, although he's Catholic. I saw in the weather forecast that Hurricane Hugo was going to hit Charleston with 140-mile-per-hour winds at 4 a.m. on Friday, September 22nd, then go west and peter out. We made plans to hit the coast in my Klepper right afterwards to play in the big swells over the weekend, this time with life preservers. I packed up the boat and camping gear into my van the night before and battened down the hatches. Hugo didn't obey the forecast and instead went due north after Charleston, going right over Charlotte and my little town of Cleveland only 6 hours later. A couple of my small fruit trees toppled over, but no big deal. I pushed them back up and staked them down. The dome did fine in the 90-mile-per-hour winds. The power and phone were out, so I couldn't phone Greg, but I assumed he was still up for the trip. Right after the winds died, I started down the road. Turning the corner to head through town on the way to the main road south, I saw that this was going to be an entirely different kind of day. The biggest tree in town had fallen on the biggest house in town, cutting it in two. The roads were cluttered with fallen limbs, and it was quite difficult to get by. When I got to Interstate 77, only one lane was open in either direction due to downed trees. Somehow, I got into Charlotte a couple of hours later, still determined to hit the coast. When I got to Greg's neighborhood, the residents were in the streets with chainsaws, clearing away large oak trees. Greg was not at home, but after some searching, I found him doing his bit as an amateur street lumberjack. The damage was astounding, with some trees not just uprooted, but also turned upside down, with the roots now in the branches of other trees. Word from the radio said that the National Guard was stationed along the coast with loaded M-16s to shoot looters, so our trip to the coast was out. However, I did have my boat and all my gear, and there was plenty of water around. With everything torn up and Charlotte alone having lost 100,000 trees, there wasn't much else to do. So the next day, we paddled down the Yadkin while it was 18 feet over flood, trying not to get tangled in the treetops. That would have been foolhardy. Each December for the last 9 years, the Creative Council for Psychotic Awareness put on the Tacky Party for the alternative artistic oddballs who kept Charlotte weird. To make things manageable, only 1,000 tickets were sold. The venue this year was a vacant warehouse, suitably decked out in day-glow monstrosities. The mascot for the party was Ralph, the barfing dog, who was immortalized in neon. Big Bob, of upstairs toilet fame, was the main character pulling it off, and also one of my best local customers. A fair proportion of the attendants were enjoying my blotter, thanks to his intercession. I went, wearing my neoprene wetsuit in costume, as the human prophylactic, which resulted in multiple pinches by buxom babes. At this party, Waywired Willie met Alice, his dream date, starting a relationship, culminating in marriage a year later, just in time for the 1990 Tacky Party. There they had a wedding cake made of Twinkies, certainly a food for the ages, or should I say, a food that never ages, as would be appropriate for a lasting confluence of lives. Alas, the 1990 party was the last of its kind, as the logistics became overwhelming. Ralph had lost his last lunch, and Charlotte got a little more normal. Right after Christmas, Jim, his friend Brent, and a fellow named Paul joined me on another trip to Cumberland Island. This time, we took both my Klepper and Jim's, rigged with my paddle pal gear. When we got there, it had just snowed for the first time in 75 years. We launched at about 1:30 p.m. off of snow and ice. After dark, sea ice formed on our decks. We continued paddling for 12 hours until we found just the right place to stop. Last year, Jim and I had not been so selective and landed in mud full of sharp oyster shells that reached up to our waists. Next morning, my thumbs were completely inoperative, and if it weren't for my adaptive gear, I would have been unable to paddle any further. I couldn't use a zipper until the next day, and my thumbs hurt for 6 weeks. We did the 60-mile circumnavigation of the island in 5 days, with 4 dolphin encounters and some very brazen wildlife. 1990. Eeny, weeny, chilly, beeny, the spirits are about to speak. The oracle was nearing completion, and I devoted all my time and energy through the winter to finishing it up. I'd done some channeling with Gary Weinreb, one of the first people I met in Charlotte, which gave me some final course corrections, but the situation was insecure and unsettling. Finally, the day arrived on April 1st, when I could assemble the entire elaborate apparatus, a couple of tons of gear, and throw the switch. Gary came up to witness the grand event. Nothing happened. I spent the next week trying every combination I could think of, but finally had to admit defeat. Rainbow was able to do a reading a couple of weeks later that threw a lot of light on the situation. I can't go into details, but it was clear that the project was premature. As a result, I was not given guidelines that were entirely correct, nor did I know enough of the underlying physics to tell the difference and designed around the mistakes. The current position of ignorance and separation from full awareness of other planes is not distinct from our separation from extraterrestrial civilizations. is quite deliberate and necessary, and part of the whole drama of how and why people come here to have human lives. When the time is right, these constraints will fall away. I give a more detailed analysis in my write-up of the Oracle Project, where it is more appropriate. The best method I knew at the time for selfless service was my work on the Oracle, to make a demonstrable interface to other planes and intelligences, and to be one of many working to bring science and religion together. This will happen in time. I didn't do it to have yet another attachment, so time came to let it go. Things could be worse. David and Sarah moved to Wichita Falls after leaving Las Cruces. David got more and more psychotic, probably from his pain medications, and wanted to fly to Switzerland and die of a heroin overdose in Needle Park. Sarah divorced him. David had poor eyesight and was frequently in car crashes, and a few years later finally had one that was fatal. The Rainbow Gathering was in Minnesota this year. I'd never been there and knew the canoeing was grand, so I gave it a thumbs up. After inquiries among the local hippies as to possible riders, one was referred to me, and late in June, a young woman was dropped off at my place. All her camping gear and food was stored in paper bags. I informed her that we were going into the land of 10,000 lakes, which would imply a certain tendency to humidity that would destroy her bags. I showed her my nylon stuff sacks, waterproof backpack cover, and dry bags for kayaking. But she insisted that she didn't want to do things the way other people did. I detected possible trouble ahead. This was not a mistaken impression. She told me she was 7 months pregnant by a man now held in a Florida insane asylum. Okay, I thought. I'm willing to go with the flow. She most certainly did not know about my stash of a couple thousand hits, and I aimed to keep it that way. I put her tofu, soy milk, and yogurt in my ice chest, and stowed her other things as best I could. It was great to have company, and the start of the trip was quite cheerful. I did all the driving in my one-ton van, bought the gas, and had her do the navigation. After we got out of North Carolina and away from my usual routes, I noticed that we were repeatedly missing turnoffs. It seems she didn't want to follow rules and preferred to use her intuition to know which exit to take. Maps and directions were used by everyone else, and she wanted to be unique, free from the paternalistic paradigm. My good humor faded. After the second night, we were nearing our goal when I detected a certain unpleasant odor. Her food containers had ruptured in my ice chest and spoiled all the contents. Even with my Buddha-like yogic equanimity, it was a trial to keep from yelling at her. Finally, we arrived in the northeast corner of Minnesota near the Canadian border, and with considerable relief, I unloaded our gear. Her bags had ruptured, spreading almonds and various other foodstuffs into various nooks and crannies of my van. I continued to find unwelcome evidence of her unique packing style for a few months afterwards. Had our association continued much longer, a local insane asylum would look pretty good after all. My sympathies to the father-to-be in Florida. It was a splendid gathering. I had been tense and upset about the latest failures, as well as with chronic isolation from women. With the loving kindness of my friends and a solid dose of mushrooms, I relaxed, stepped back, and got things in perspective, especially after the traumatic drive north. Rodan was at the gathering with the usual contingent of Denton-area hippies, and we continued on after the gathering to the Boundary Waters canoe area, straddling the border. Highly recommended, although canoes really are better suited to the local conditions than kayaks. After a couple of nights camping, we traveled along the northern coast of the Great Lakes. In Ontario, we toured the Kanawha International Canoe and Kayak Museum, run by Michael Kettimer, who had fled a career teaching clarinet at the conservatory in Toronto. They had some 500 boats, including the original Inuit and Aleut Russian kayaks of driftwood, bone, and sealskin. Michael saw the hair halfway down my back and said the inspections at customs entering the U.S. could be intrusive. I mailed all but a handful of my LSD first class to myself across the border. In the event, there was no difficulty. The customs officer was crew cut and curt, asking me about all the piles of bags in the back and the kayak on my roof rack. Finally, he said he'd taught kayaking, liked my gear, go on ahead, and have a nice trip. I said we certainly would. Rodan and I showed up tired and bedraggled at my dad's apartment. I took Rodan on several paddles, and then we visited Anton upstairs at his parents'. He was convinced he was the world's most powerful credit broker, and evidently some others thought so too, for some reason. He had been abroad, hosted by the rich and powerful of several nations. Rodan thought he was racist, delusional, and greedy, which allowed him to fit right in with the people who run the world. Anton showed us a copy of a prospectus for New York Guarantee and Trust that showed a complete list of fabricated financial information. He learned how to do this from Ivan Boesky, whom he admired. This was the last time I would see Anton in person. After paddling with Rodan in Martha's Vineyard, I was exhausted, and we headed back to North Carolina. I took 2 months to recover. In August, Anshul Brusiloff told me he'd be coming to North Carolina and would stop by for a visit. He'd give me a call when nearby and told me the 3 days he'd be around. During those days, I hung by the phone, waiting for the call, canceling all other activities. He forgot all about it and never said he was sorry. That's what my life in music was like. The local pharmacist knew me pretty well from the several medications I took, and one day in the fall she introduced me to Susan Davies in a little shop she ran on the main street in Cleveland. Susan was a very warm and friendly presence who was a real light in the community. She in turn introduced me to her husband Ray, who ran his own small construction company and was building their home in the woods next to his parents' house. Through them, I found the interesting people living in this neck of the woods, including Reverend Diane and Fred Corlett. Diane was the rector at the local Episcopal church. In the sermons I heard, she never mentioned Voltaire or the fires of hell once, which I found refreshing. Finally, I found neighbors who were educated, cultured, and friendly. I started having real social interactions, not requiring long drives. In November, Anton phoned from the Philippines, where he'd been for a month. His friend Ronnie Marcos, evidently the adopted son of Ferdinand, was coming to the States. Anton told him to come by my home to help get the oracle working. Urban legend had it that Ferdy had adopted Ronnie to keep the KGB from kidnapping him to use his psychic powers. Anton said he saw Ronnie demonstrating mind-reading and telekinesis. One example was that he could make calls on a toy phone by using his hand as a satellite dish to make the connection, as he did once to get a visa to the U.S. Anton said he vibrates at a high frequency that annoys the ears, and that he would come by my place after seeing George Bush. I said, no thanks, having already experienced his friends. Later, Ronnie predicted a world war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union starting at 2 a.m. March 16th, 1991. After that date, he fell into obscurity. Meanwhile, Anton kept up the chase. After 400,000 tons of Japanese gold buried during World War II. Also in November, Gerald Blow and Carolyn came to North Carolina. Gerald had starred in the title role in R. Crumb Comics, directed by Johnny Simons, in a presentation by Fort Worth's Hip Pocket Theater. Simons had noted Gerald's remarkable resemblance to the eccentric underground cartoonist, resulting in thespian excess of appropriate proportions. Now the director was doing another production of the play with students at Duke, and wanted Gerald to come by to give his critique. As an extra bonus, Leonardo da Crum himself was going to be in town for rehearsals. Gerald and Carolyn picked me up, and off we went to Durham. Crumb was every bit as odd as I'd hoped for, constantly sketching with his technical pens. We had a fine dinner together and traded a few acid stories. Crumb and his wife Alice were moving to France, which he described as womb-like and far more comfortable for his delicate sensibilities. For Christmas, while Anton was dining with the Prime Minister of Malaysia, Jim McGuire and his new wife, Lou, introduced me to rural South Carolina culture. We visited her parents' home in the little town of Sally. Seems the local gentry, including the local judge and prominent lawyers, thought Hitler was a liberal, and that slavery was a pretty good economic model. At Christmas dinner, talk went to guns, and I realized that every male at the table was packing heat. Afterwards, they invited me to stay the next day and try my hand at firing a machine gun. But instead, we packed up for 3 days of kayaking in the rain at the mouth of the Edisto River. 1991, enjoying my freedom. Bad news from Warner Robins Air Force Base and their struggle against jazzless communism in defense of our Halusian nation. Fred said the new commander, a certain Major Sapp, no kidding, who conducted the concert band was not so receptive to music like mine. Fred got him to agree to a read-through of the Munster Variations, but couldn't persuade him to actually look at the score before the rehearsal. This was one of my more intricate pieces, and the attempt to play it on sight was catastrophic. Commander Sapp said the piece, quote, wouldn't play with the blue hairs, unquote, and that was that. There were two jazz band pieces that Fred could have conducted, the big popular music of Planet X and the short For Those Who Fell, a war memorial for jazz band. But the musicians couldn't manage Planet X. By contrast, For Those Who Fell was simple, slow, and quite tonal, and thus my best shot at performance. But when the Gulf War looked likely, the Pentagon came out with a directive saying they didn't want any music that would remind audiences that Americans die in war. That would be bad for business, which was exactly what I was hoping for. I had also sent him a saxophone quartet arranged from Art of the Recorder, which his friends couldn't quite handle. In addition, there was a woodwind quintet and a brass quintet. But when I phoned those musicians directly, they didn't know who I was, even though Fred had given them my music, which lingered at the bottom of their slush piles. After a year and a half of labor, once again, all was lost. With no oracle and no musicians, I was on my own. My big plan was to sell just enough LSD to buy electronic synthesis gear and thus be able to make my own recordings. After that, I would quit the trade for good. It seemed my great good luck that Big Bob, found a buyer who wanted 10,000 doses a month. And so in the spring, we started supplying him. I figured by fall I would be set. I was still digging out of the hole from Anton's investment advice and from spending $20,000 on the Oracle, which left me with very low reserves. True, I had the occasional nightmare about arrest and living in a jail cell, but I dismissed these as negative waves. It came to me that I could use the same adaptive gear that allowed me to paddle kayaks to play the violin. So I rigged a mast and a boom that fit to a folding chair and used a shock cord clipping to a sling on my bow arm. Mom reported that Burns was deteriorating, presumably from Alzheimer's, so that I could borrow one of his violins. I mounted it on a camera tripod, much as I had done 10 years previously. It took several months to get my chops back, and before I was ready, I gave a truly dreadful performance at Diane's Episcopal Church that Easter. But by summer, I was playing almost as well as I ever had, and performed Bach's Chaconne and one of my own sonatas in Charlotte. I took the opportunity to make my own electric violin, the first of several. To have something to play, I re-edited my old set of 21 sonatas, trimming the fat and recomposing some weaker sections until I had a set of 16. However, by June, my right shoulder hurt quite a bit, giving me some sleepless nights. Meanwhile, on the domestic front, my landlady wanted to sell the property. Since I couldn't buy it, she found a fellow seriously red of neck to buy it. He pulled a house trailer into the field next to my home, and by summer I was paying rent to him. Attempts to tell him what I was doing in music or science were entirely futile. The Rainbow Gathering was in Vermont, so I lined up my New England friends for my summer adventure. Before leaving, I placed a third order for Big Bob's customer so that it would be delivered after my return. I packed my mahogany single, Klepper double, sailing gear, and my violin with a battery and portable amplifier. Jim McGuire and I drove up together with kayaking in mind. At the gathering, I found a flutist with classical training, and we performed the first movement of the Bach Concerto for Two Violins for a small group of hippies and a lot of trees and nature spirits. This was a piece Bill Schneider taught me at Andover. I found myself growing away from the rainbow scene and wondered where I would find a spiritual community to take its place. What I had to offer was of little value to the community, and I was not learning much from them. Afterwards, Jim and I drove to show off my boats for a day at a small craft exhibition on Lake Champlain. At that point, I was doing my varnishing with a toothpick, and my single was nice and shiny. After some banging around Camden Harbor, Jim and I camped for a couple of days, eating mussels off the rocks and lobsters off the boats. I chomped down a couple of grams of mushrooms for my last trip. Phenomenal! We went down to Danvers to see Dad, which was my final visit with him. At his age and with shaky health, I always assumed that any visit might be the last. Anton was hobnobbing with the nabobs in Hong Kong. Jim and I went for a paddle across Beverly Harbor, around Salem and over to Marblehead and back. On our return, we noticed a crowd on the pier at the end of Salem Neck, with a television crew and some small Coast Guard boats. Later, we watched the local news and saw ourselves paddling on the TV as background to a murder story. Thomas Maimani had gone sailing with a woman and come back alone, saying she'd fallen overboard. A lobsterman pulled up her body with a weight belt around her waist and an anchor around 1 foot at a spot marked with an X on Maimani's chart. The lobsters had eaten the corpse down to the bones in 6 days. Maimani got life in prison. After dropping Jim off at the airport, I drove to see Bill and Seji Schneider at their home in New Hampshire. Bill had been fired from Andover due to mental illness and had stopped playing violin altogether. Now he carved wooden ducks. Although I was dismayed and frustrated with my musical failure, he was overjoyed that one of his students took music so seriously and that his teaching had continuing importance. Then on to see John and Jackie and her parents, and then on home. As I drove onto my street, I noticed a sheriff's car coming in the other direction. That's odd, I thought. I've hardly ever seen any law enforcement in this area. I was working on a cabin for the Klepper, including a plexiglass dome, so that I could sleep and camp on board, and even attempt offshore passages. It was near completion. I am most fortunate that I didn't get a chance to use it in the wild, as it was a most elegant technology for drowning. Big Bob assured me in dulcet tones that everything was fine on his end. The latest package of 10,000 doses was due Monday, July 29th, but did not arrive. I called FedEx, and the operator transferred me to another line, where I was assured that it was en route, although delayed. I called again Wednesday, July 31st, and they said it would arrive by 4 p.m. At about 2:30, a very friendly FedEx courier knocked on my door, and with a big grin, gave me my envelope. There was another fellow back in his truck inspecting the scene. I unpacked the contents, divided the 10 pages into hundreds as usual, stuck them in my freezer, and went back to doing the copywork for my solo violin sonatas. At 3:30, I heard a loud banging on the door and the words, "Police, we have a warrant, open up." I looked behind me through a window and saw a car driving on the lawn to my back door. I set down my pen and did not write another note for 11 years.